What's going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of Unscripted, the show that brings you professionals from all walks of life, touching on their backstory, their mindset, and how they navigate through adversity and opposition, while providing you practical tips that might help you on your path. I'm your host, two-time Olympian, Olympic bronze medalist, author, and motivational speaker, Hakeem Haynes. Now, let's get into the episode. This week, my guest on the show, he's got over 20 years in sports journalism. He spent 15 plus years as a writer for the Toronto Star, as a sports reporter where he covered everything from CFL, Canadian Football League, to Major League Baseball, to the UFC, writing daily stories but specializing in longer features that explore the intersection of sports and social issues. He is now CBC Sports' first senior contributor. In 2004, he won the National Newspaper Award for Long Shots, a serial narrative about a high school basketball team from Scarborough. 5 years ago, he stepped on a stage to give a TED Talk where he touched on race, sports, and telling true stories. If you have a few minutes on your hands, definitely check that out. He's also been featured in the New York Times, where he writes on boxing news. If you're a boxing fan like me, you'll love the articles. My guest this week is Morgan Campbell. Morgan is well decorated in his field and isn't afraid to share his honest thoughts. He's built a reputation, a following, a brand on examining the game behind the game. In his TED Talk, something he said towards the end of the video really stuck with me. He said, "Once you get rid of the cliches and get rid of the safety nets, you are left with the truth, and journalists are in the truth business." I had a great conversation with Morgan, and we touched on a lot of different topics, including the process of writing his memoir, which is coming out soon. We talk about cultural shifts growing up as an American Canadian. We talk about the process of what it was like when he found out his father was diagnosed with cancer, and ultimately he did lose his father as a young teenager. We talk about the backstory behind the start of his journalism career, stories from his years with Toronto Star, including an incident that happened with Anson Carter and the media that was around him. We talk about why integrity and truth should be the foundation of every story, the backstory why he left Toronto Star, his TED Talk entitled Race, Sports, and Telling True Stories, and we talk a little boxing. We talk a little bit of Gervonta Davis versus Ryan Garcia that is taking place in April or May, I believe it is. And we talk about so much more. But before you check out the episode, if you could do me a huge favor and leave a rating and review of the podcast, wherever it is that you can leave rating and reviews, it would truly help the show and would be greatly appreciated and would really, really mean a lot to us. If you prefer watching your podcast in visual form, then definitely subscribe to the YouTube channel and check out the visual episodes over there. All of the links will be in the show notes below. So with all that being said, enjoy this week's episode with Morgan Campbell.
I start each episode the same as I did last season.
Let's do it.
Because I started with gratitude, man. It's how I've started my day since I was 7 years old, and it's how I'll continue to do it. So today, man, give me three things you're grateful for today, man.
Oh, geez. I'm grateful for my family, my wife, my daughter, like my immediate family, but also my broader family. My wife, whom you know my wife, Perdita Felician, and then our daughter, Nova. Our niece lives with us now. She's about 20. She moved in a couple of years ago. So our house is sort of like a sitcom. It's like Family Matters. But you know what? I wouldn't trade it. I love it. I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for my health. You know, I'm in my mid-40s now. And, you know, I'm at that age when you have to stay on top of it. Because, like, the little things can turn into big things if you get to your 40s and you don't take care of them. You know, and not to, because I don't like to remind myself that I'm lucky by contrasting myself to people who are not as lucky. But the same thing, but at the same time, I know I can't take my health for granted, because I know there are people my age who, like, just like we were joking about getting out here and shoveling snow for 2 hours. There's people my age that can't do that, you know? Yeah. So I'm grateful for my health and I don't take it for granted. So, like, You know, yeah, I went to Timmy's this morning because I was feeling super Canadian. After 2.5 hours of shoveling snow, I just felt like, let me do the even more Canadian thing and go to Timmy's. But, like, you know, in general, I try to eat right and, you know, get my movement in every day. And so I'm grateful for the health that I have, but I don't take it for granted. And I try to, it's like an account that I try to keep paying into so that I can tap into it. Third thing I'm grateful for, health, family, like those are the two big ones. And I'm grateful for like opportunities. I don't know like what questions you're going to have, but whatever, we'll get into that during the show. But like professionally, it's easy to get caught up on the things you're not doing, caught up on the things you wish you could be doing. But at the same time, like in the 3 years since I've been like working for myself, you know, I feel like I've accomplished a lot. I've taken advantage of the opportunities that have come my way, but I've also been able to go out and like create more opportunities. And so I'm grateful that I can still do that, that I've been able to do that, you know, and that I've been able to keep working and keep writing and then branch out into some other stuff. You know, it's like the media industry. As consumers of media, we see people that make a lot of money. We see people that are high profile. You look at ESPN, you see Stephen A. Smith making probably 8 figures a year. And you think that it's like you think the industry is less of a grind and a hustle than it actually is. It's not an easy industry to these days, especially, right? With like so many outlets shrinking, contracting, laying off. It's not easy. It's a tough racket. It's always been a tough racket, but even now it's an even tougher racket. So I'm grateful for, again, the opportunities that I get, that I receive, and the ones that I'm able to create. So I don't take any of that for granted.
And we're going to talk about that a little bit later, man, because I have an interesting thought on that, on the perception of certain things, writing, sports as well, too. But I actually want to go here, Morgan, because you're working on your memoir coming out. When's that coming out?
This time next year. So the tentative release date is January 9th, 2024. That might change. And I have no inside knowledge on whether or not it might change, but I just know as this process is unfolded, like all kinds of dates get set and then they change. But right now, January 2024, like the book is done. We're just, you know, getting ready to copy edit it. So it's done. We're just waiting for, you know, some copy editing, release date.
Man, that's like, you know, that decades of writing you have under you in the writing space, experience and all these different things. Right. But the process of writing a book is a little bit different, you know, it, because it's, especially when it's about you, it's opening up parts of you that maybe you are ready to talk about, but not really, or maybe you are trying to give a different light. But what's been that process like for you? And Morgan, why is now the right time for a memoir?
So I'll do your... Okay, I'll answer the second question first, and then you can remind me what the first question was. But now is the right time because for me, like writing about my family. So just to get everybody caught up, I have a memoir coming out, and basically, it's about me growing up Black and American in Canada in a family where the two halves don't get along, like, at all. Okay, so the fact that we are Black in a country where most of the people are white, but then also African American in a country, in a region where most of the Black people are from the Caribbean, like, you know, you're in a minority in two ways. And this is not to complain about. This is just the setting, right? And this, it just also... all that tension gives you a lot of fertile ground for storytelling. Like, so many stories emerge from that tension. And now was the right time for it, mainly because to write about your family, you know, I love my parents, love my mom, love my dad. even like my mom's dad and my dad's mom, who were like the two people who really did not get along, and they had beef with each other from Chicago, literally from the 1930s, brought this beef across decades, across borders. And, you know, and it kind of is like this cloud overhanging our family. But the point is, to write about those people, I only really, you know, growing up, I only knew them as old people, as older people.
Yeah.
And I kind of had to pass through some phases of my life and get to a point where I could look back and understand my grandfather as like a young man and a middle-aged man, and then to understand him as an older man. And write about these people as people as opposed to just as grandparents. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so like
yeah.
When I write the book, there's points where I call my his name was Claude. There's points in the book where I call him Claude, parts of the book where I call him Grandpa. But like, it didn't make sense if I'm writing about something that happened to him when he was 20 to call him Grandpa.
You didn't,
because
know
he was not a grandpa. He's a young man doing 20-year-old things. So it helped to have that perspective because I understand them better. You know, writing, if I had written this book 20 years ago, you know, it would probably have been a lot angrier, a lot more bitter, because I didn't, and I, you know, and I can still judge them, you know, for the things they did to start and prolong fights in our family. But at the same time, it took a little while to live enough life to understand those stages of life, to write about people with empathy, like, and this is even as they are double crossing family members, right, and doing really hurtful things, but you still have to write about them, you know, as complete human beings, and write about them with empathy. So I think that's why now was a better time than, say, when I was like 25. Also, and then just from a practical standpoint, it's easier to sell a first memoir, you know, when you are an established professional journalist than it is when you're like just some guy who just finished university and say, here, I want you to care about my story. And the publisher's like, why should I care about your story? Who are you? Yeah. So those two, there's a practical reason for why now is the right time in terms of being able to tell the story. But then there's the practical reason in terms of being able to sell the story. And so what was the first half of your question?
Well, you answered it. You answered it. You kind of talked about the process of it a little bit, but it actually brought me to this next question, Morgan, because, you know, I was born in Jamaica, left 7-8 years old, right? Went northern Canada.
Yeah, you went way up there, man.
Oh, I went way up there. And before I came to Calgary, and I grew up in Calgary, but even in my earliest adolescent years, it's like growing, being all to a class in Jamaica where it's all black kids to going to Yellowknife, where, you know, for the early times I was, if not the only person of color inside that class. And as a black American Canadian, what was that like, man? Like, because, you know, you're a couple years older than me, so the times were a little bit different.
just a few.
Two or three. So the times were a little bit different. But when you look back as you're working on this book, what was those times like back then? And as a young adolescent trying to figure out how to navigate through it, what were some of those early questions that you had?
Oh, see, now you're asking big, big, big questions that don't really fit in a podcast. But I'll tell you a couple things for you youngsters, right? Because one, this was like in the pre-BET in Canada era, right? So, like, I think Brandon Gomez had this debate on his Instagram page the other day. Like, if you grew up in Toronto, did you get BET on channel 49 or did you get it on channel 57? And I'm like, I got BET on VHS tapes from my cousins when I would go visit them in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And you just stick the tape in the VCR and let it run. And you'd come home, you'd have 6 hours of BET, and it would be whatever was on BET. You just let it run. Like, that's how I got BET when I was a teenager. In terms of, so I said all that to say this, like African American culture is very pervasive, right? It's probably, I can't think of another culture like in the history of the planet that has spread as far as African American culture and has influenced so many other cultures, not at gunpoint, Do you see what I'm saying? People speak English everywhere in the world, but there's a reason for that, right? It's because the English went at gunpoint. We own this land now. You guys speak our language now. Like, African Americans have not gone anywhere and forced our language, forced our culture on anyone. People just pick it up, right? With the internet, that's become very accelerated. Social media has become very accelerated, but you know, my book is taking place mostly in the 1990s. This was before like that explosion, but it was still like so when I talk about like when I discuss African American culture and the way people engaged it, like you could engage it, you know, listening to WBLK from Buffalo if you lived here in Toronto, or like looking at TV shows, you know, Cosby Show, Different World, the Arsenio Hall Show, stuff like that. But it's one thing to watch it on TV and something else entirely to have it in your home and to grow up with African-American parents who really made it a point and made sure that my sisters and I grew up connected to Black America, connected to the culture, connected to the history. And again, like all these years later, I thank them for that, because I'm the person I'm not and the person I'm glad I'm not is like, I acknowledge my African American history person. I acknowledge my African American heritage person without like really embracing it or engaging with it. Like you've asked me what I am. I'm like, I'm Canadian, but I am also African American. I don't diminish either of those identities and I don't run from either of them. Mm-hmm. And people ask me, well, how can you be both at the same time? Like, well, because I can.
You know what I mean? You know, it's funny even to say that, because it's like I have dual citizenship, right, from Jamaica and Canada. It's like you can be both. It is a thing.
Exactly. Like from a citizenship standpoint, but also from the standpoint of identity and like the culture you engage, the dialects you can understand even if you don't speak them. You know, like I don't say schedule. You know, I say schedule. But at the same time, like, you know, I know what it's like to, I know the difference between Smarties and M&Ms, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas if I had grown up in the US, I would not know the difference between Smarties and M&Ms. I wouldn't know what Smarties are. So little things like that. But it does tie up to, like, it does connect to questions of identity that we explore in the memoir.
Now, one last question I have regarding the childhood, Morgan, because I'm sure you cover all this in the book coming up too, man. And I came across it, and I'm going to shoot out the date, and hopefully it lines up with where I'm going.
Okay.
Sunday, June 21st, 2015, right? Father's Day. You know, you wrote a piece that I came across, and it was talking about your father.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
The cancer that you guys found out about, and that moving forward, what age did that happen, man? And how did you navigate through that, right? Because I think when you're young, you look up to your parents.
Yeah.
And men especially, you know, if you have a father that you respect and actually like, you want to have some of those same attributes. But that may have been taken away from you a little bit earlier than you would have liked to, right? So
yeah.
What was that process like navigating through that, man?
Okay, yeah. And so, like, spoiler alerts. So my dad died. I was probably 16. Sorry. He was diagnosed with cancer when I was 16, turning 17, and he died the following year. You know, and, like, his death is kind of like the midpoint of my memoir, like, that year. And this is another of the reasons that it made sense to write the book later than sooner, because again, you get some perspective on like being a parent, what goes through a parent's head, you know, when times are tough, like what do they really want to let their kids know about? What do they not want to let their kids know about? You know, so like my dad, the last year of his life, did a really good job of like not letting people know that he wasn't feeling good. You know, he's like, yeah, I got my chemotherapy, I'm good. And so, like, being around him, you thought that he would have a lot more time than he did. But, you know, with his illness, he was healthy seeming for 11 months. Then the last 2.5 weeks, he went downhill quick. So that was, like, a lot to process for me at 17. because you know he's diagnosed with cancer, you know, but within a month he's seeming normal, and he's like, "Yeah, I'll live a long time. It's fine." And so, fast forward to you know, like literally the last 2 weeks before his death, it just overtook him so quickly. It was a lot to process. Like one day you have a dad, next day the dad's in the hospital, next day he's in the morgue. It was quick. Yeah. But I mean, one of the things that taught me back then is that there's a lot of stuff, again, that you can't take for granted. Like, appreciate your parents, appreciate the protection and the guidance if they're good parents, you know. You know, and we all have to basically prepare to bury our parents at some point, but like, yeah, 17 is a little soon for that, but at the same time, I think what it taught me was not to feel sorry for myself, you know. But then that was a choice, like, because I really could have felt sorry for myself and just tried to surround myself with people who would only feel sorry for me, you know. But it taught me that, like, I couldn't do that. And like, not feeling sorry for myself is not the same as not missing the person that has died. You know, you can,
that's good. Yeah.
You can miss that person and you can like, acknowledge like what you lose when you lose that person. But feeling sorry for yourself, like it's, you know, sort of like a drug. It might feel good in the moment. Once you get hooked on that sympathy, man, it's like, it's hard to get off. And so for me, like that was the big, not, yeah, like one of the takeaways, you know? But at 17, turning 18, I didn't quite understand it as well as I do now, like looking back on it, you know. But it was quite a year. It was quite a year. But the big, again, the big thing I came away with that from is that like all this stuff, our health, our loved ones, can't take them for granted. So you should do your best to appreciate them. And that like bad stuff might happen. Well, okay, bad stuff might happen to me, but like, it didn't happen to me. It happened to my father. So like, how much can I really feel sorry for myself?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not the one that had cancer. I'm healthy. Yeah. So I can feel bad, but like, it ain't about me. Cause I'm not the one that actually had to feel all this pain. Right. And so I did learn the limits of like self-pity and self-sympathy. Like some of that is natural, but like, you got to have this switch that turns off because, hey man, especially as my last year of high school, like universities, they needed their applications at a certain time. They didn't have time for me to feel sorry for myself. Like they needed by this date. So there was stuff that had to get done. And I got it done. But yeah. Hope that answers your question.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Because the way how you were talking about it, it's like, man, you had the words then when you wrote it, but they probably weren't as sharp as it was when you were going through it.
You know, no, it's the other way. It's the other way.
It's the other way.
Yeah, in the moment, sometimes it's hard to find the words, but then like years later, you're like, oh yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. That's what I was feeling. Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's spot on with the empathy part, man, because at the end of the day, people still need to get their things done. I mean, I remember at the Olympic Games for me in the last one, you know, I had a very, very good friend of mine who was dying of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I spoke to him the night before and very, 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 very good relationship.
Mm.
And, you know, he said something to me in past tense and it was in my mind of just like, oh, frig, this guy doesn't think he's going to make it past another day. Mm-hmm. And it kind of hits you, but it's like, no, you still got to show up at the start line because yep. the team's depending on you.
Yep. Right.
So it's that process of, man, you still got to continue moving, continue going. But Morgan, I want to go to the beginning stages of your speaking career just a little bit, man, how you got this profession, because it's not one of those things where people may see it and they're like, oh man, like I think there's a misconception about it, because when we look back at some of the writers that are most popular, say like mm-hmm. the Hemingways and the Faulkner,
mm-hmm.
those guys are depressed. You know what I'm saying? Like, and they turn to certain things.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What, and I think certain things is more of a calling or a pulling a little bit. What led you towards this career path from your earliest memory about it?
Oh man. Jeez. I don't know. I'll put it to you like this. I'll give you the condensed version. It was about 15. I really started to get interested in writing. Reading is a hobby, writing. It's funny, even before that, my parents had just got me the subscription to Sports Illustrated, you know, just as a way to get me to read.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it worked. So like one of my big hobbies became reading Sports Illustrated. You know, but I didn't really start thinking about writing as something to do until about halfway through high school. But I did notice, you know, that a lot of the people we read, like the Hemingways of the world and the F. Scott Fitzgeralds, like these people, they died some combination of broken, depressed, often pretty young. So I'm like, well, do I want to be a novelist? Because what it looks like to me is that you could write a great novel and no one will buy it. And then they discover it after you die. And then they wind up, everyone buys it because it winds up in all the high schools, but you can't do anything with it because you died, you know, in an alcoholic stupor at age 39. That's not what I want to do. I want to pay the bills,
yeah,
but still write. So that's how I started gravitating towards journalism. And again, that's the condensed version, but that was how that happened. And that was how I wound up deciding on journalism over like full-time creative writing, trying to write novels, stuff like that. I wanted to write for a living, but I also wanted a steady paycheck and keep the bills paid.
It's a bit of a grind, man. You know, and I remember you were speaking about calling it like the scrum, right? When you're trying to get an article from someone or an interview and like there's so many people there.
Yeah.
What was that early grind like, man? Because it's probably a little bit different now than it is back then, maybe. What was it kind of like?
As a sports writer, you mean?
Yeah.
I think the difference now is that especially since the pandemic, I mean, you're starting to see more scrums now where like the athlete has their back against the wall and the corporate, the backdrop festooned with the corporate logos and the reporters all make that semicircle around him or her and stick the mics in the face. But since the onset of the pandemic and so much more media availability takes place, virtually, there's a lot less of the scrum, mm-hmm. which I don't necessarily mind because I don't like being close to people and breathing on people and all this. But then there is also a lot less, to borrow your phrase, like unscripted one-on-one talk
with
athletes. And you lose a lot. Like teams love it because if I'm the Brooklyn Nets, do I want Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, especially just like talking one-on-one, saying whatever, and we can't supervise and shut down the interview? No, I'm not. I don't, because they are liable to say anything. And then they're going to start a media relations fire that we got to put out. And that's not what we want. But if everything takes place like in a structured media availability format, then we can say, all right, Kyrie's at the head table or Kyrie's on Zoom. We got time for five questions. After five questions, he's leaving. That's it. And so what the organization gains is just the ability to know what's out there and like control the message. And they don't have to worry about Jacques Vaughn doing an interview over here with me telling you that Kyrie is hurt, and Kyrie across the room doing an interview with you saying, F Jacques Vaughn, I'm fine. He's just a jerk and he doesn't want to play me. Right?
Yeah.
If you can keep everybody in the same place at the same time, saying the same thing, you're going to get a lot of the same story in a lot of different outlets. But like teams don't mind that. All they care is that everyone is covering them and that their visibility remains high. And it's actually easier for the team if every outlet has the same story, as opposed to, again, me writing one thing about what Jacques Vaughn says, Kyrie cussing out Jacques Vaughn to you over there, and they got to deal with that. So that's one of the big differences between like sports writing now and sports writing, you know, back when I was getting like early 2000s when I was getting into the industry.
I remember reading and hearing you talking about an interaction that you had with Anson Carter and kind of what kind of happened a little bit after. But in that sense, Morgan, how do you handle the emotions of maybe like anger or frustration towards something that you're trying to get across towards the critical side of it, where people are saying, man, you don't know what you're doing. You don't know what you're talking about. How do you not let the anger make you write something that is out of your character? You know, how do you
that? Well, listen, some of the people I work with would tell you that anger is my character. Like, they wouldn't be right, but you know. In that situation, like quick recap for your listeners. Like, I'd done a story in a small scrum situation back when I was probably about 23 with Anson Carter, who was playing for the Oilers back then, the Edmonton Oilers. And, you know, and they had 5 black players on the team, which is a lot for an NHL team.
Especially. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm asking Anson about race in the NHL, and he's cool. He's answering the questions. And there's this white guy also got his microphone stuck in there, and I finish my questions, I leave. He's still asking Anson Carter questions. Turned out that white guy, and the thing is, I didn't know the white guy, and the white guy didn't know me. So I thought he was just a guy. He thought I was like some high school student or something. He didn't realize that I was working for the Toronto Star. So the next day in the National Post, he writes his column about Anson Carter saying, pressed by a minority reporter to comment on racism in the NHL, Carter said simply, I'm not a politician, I'm a hockey player. A couple things wrong with that. Like, one, what does minority have to do with it? Two, like, again, I wasn't from the school paper, I was from the competitor, I was from the Toronto Star. Three, you know, when I was asking Anson Carter these questions, we were talking normally. I wasn't pressing him. He was happy to answer the questions because he doesn't get smart questions on race very often, especially from, you know, the people who were covering hockey back then. And the fact that this writer, you know, forced this point of view onto Anson Carter, projected it onto him. I'm not a politician, I'm a hockey player. Anson Carter did not say that. He said he was happy to talk about race and racism in the NHL.
Yeah.
But this is one of these things where you could do that back then because there weren't like cameras everywhere, right? Whereas now there'd be more cameras and people would be recording on their phones and someone would post the raw audio and video of what the question was and what the answer was, and you'd be able to get the context. So if you read the two articles, like mine had the context, his did not, but he thought he could play the he said, she said game with me because he didn't think he didn't think I worked for a major publication. So whatever he said about that interaction, he figured would stand. And it was funny. So I went to work the next day and it was a white colleague, the sports editor, pointed it out to me. And all my white colleagues were like, next time you see that guy, you should punch him out. So in that sense, I would have had like complete support. None of my colleagues, they would have been happy because they'd all dealt with that guy too. They didn't like him. Like, I would not necessarily have gotten in trouble with my immediate supervisor, the sports editor. But at the same time, like in the context of the industry, especially back then, like the white guys, they could get into fist fights every now and then and it's cool. But like you as a young black person, especially I was like 23 and like this guy's probably in his 40s. If I go beat up this old man, I go beat up this old white man, that's my career. Right. Yeah. Like, again, it's already easy enough to get labeled the angry black guy. Again, you go talk to some of the people that I didn't like at the Toronto Star that didn't like me. They will tell you he's an angry black guy. Again, they wouldn't necessarily be right. Or if I was angry, it's because I had a good reason to, because people do stuff like this. But yeah, I can't like go wring the guy's neck as much as he might have deserved it. But part of that is just like being a grown up and realizing, you know, it's not the high school cafeteria. You can't go body slamming people all the time. And back then I wasn't established, but I knew I was good, you know? And so maybe you don't get revenge on the guy in the moment. Like that guy just wound up, I saw him at a basketball game and I took out my business card and I wrote minority above reporter. And I just threw it on his computer keyboard.
Respectfully.
Yes. But, you know, like you get into situations like that all the time where people sell you short. Often it's because you're Black. You don't know it, but you reasonably suspect it. But the thing is, like, if you are good, like over the long run, you can prove people wrong. But I would put proving people wrong secondary to proving yourself right and proving the people who believe in you right. This is easy to just working yourself up to dunk on your haters. It's a quick hitting source of motivation, but that can't really sustain you. Unless you're like Michael Jordan, you just keep making up reasons that you think people are hating on you.
Yeah,
and you
keep yeah.
That's a hard thing to do. Like, he could do it, but I wouldn't recommend it. But stuff like that, like, I know what's going to happen. And every time it happens, like, it does upset you, but, like, you don't have to trip on it. It's not the end of your career. It's not even the end of your day, especially if you know you're good. I mean, especially if you know, like, overall, the people you work with, and the editors you work with also know that you're good and you can keep doing good work. And so, like, over time, who's right? Me or the person that tried to say I wasn't very good? Me or the who's right? Me or the person that dismissed me as Minority Reporter? You build a body of work and it becomes clear. So when I was younger, I kind of, you know, I would trip off that stuff, not too much, but, you know, because I didn't have my place in the industry and my career was a lot less established. But now I'm a little more established. Like, if somebody jumps up tomorrow on Twitter and says, Morgan Campbell actually isn't that good. All right, you can say it. I don't make it true. So hope that answers your question.
You handled that situation probably a little better than I would have handled it, especially at that age. But I've heard you say something, Morgan, that I think should be a foundation, but usually gets blurred at times. You said journalists are in the truth-telling business, but not every journalist or people I feel like fall into that category. When we talk about integrity of the story, Morgan, how much of that do you think is blurred these days in the sense of, you know, someone might say a snippet of something and let's just be the first to get it out there because that'll bring the views, that'll bring the hits. Whereas you wait a little bit and it comes from a different source that tells the full story. How much of the integrity game has, I guess, cost you opportunities or maybe growth in certain departments?
The rush to get stuff first, that's not new.
Yeah.
I think it's amplified now because publishing first used to mean getting this story, getting as much of the story as you thought you could, and then like waiting overnight and then publishing in the morning.
Yeah.
And now you can publish instantly. And the thing is, like, for me, I know I'm never going to be able to stop that. There are always going to be people who thrive on getting stuff first. There are always going to be people who make a lot of money getting stuff first, whether or not it's important, whether or not, for the most part, because let me back up. Because like the Adrian Wojnarowskis and like Adam Schefters and Shams Trainias of the world, it's not that they get stuff wrong on purpose. But their job is to get stuff fast and get stuff, not huge stories. They don't do like long features necessarily or investigations. Like, their job, the reason they make money and like how or why like the economy of any company supports huge salaries for people who publish first and foremost on Twitter is a different discussion. Point is, they have big followings.
Yeah.
You know, and their bosses see value in what they do. And there is some value in it, but their job is to like, hey, I talked to the agent. I know what trade's coming. Boom, let me tweet it. Oh, I talked to the agent. I know who they're going to talk to the team. I know they're going to talk to sources, know who they're going to draft. Boom, tweet it. And most times they're right. Sometimes they're wrong, but you know, because the medium and their specialty places such a premium on speed. And that just goes with the way they report. So like, you know, a few errors are going to happen every now and then. It's just like, you know, if your job is the only thing you do is shoot free throws and shoot them fast, you're going to make most of them, but sometimes you're going to miss because your job is to shoot the free throw fast. Hey man, that's what it is. You told me I had to shoot 10 free throws in 8 seconds. That's my job. That's my specialty. Most times I make 10, sometimes I make 8. So I don't even really get upset over that. That's just built into, you know, that part of the media ecosystem. And then for me personally, I'm happy those writers exist. A lot of people complain about them.
Yeah.
But, you know, like in the boxing world, like I write a lot about boxing. You know, like Mike Coppinger from ESPN, he's the guy that always knows 10 minutes before the next guy what fight is going to happen. So before the news conference, sources, Caleb Plant's going to fight David Benavidez, right? He's that guy, and Dan Rayfield is that guy. Sometimes they get seated next to each other at fights, and they will argue with each other over who tweeted something first, and they'll pull their phones out. I tweeted it at noon. I tweeted it at 11:58, like this. But the fact that those people exist and they do that and they put so much energy into doing that means I don't have to do it. So I don't feel any pressure to report some trade 2 minutes before the next guy, to report like a fight announcement 2 minutes before the next guy. So I can just concentrate on finding the stories I like and telling those stories. Because if I put my energy into either beating the newsbreakers by 30 seconds to tweet something, or put that energy into like lamenting that the information economy is this way instead of another way, then that's energy and time I can't put into telling the stories I want to tell. And so at a certain point, I just had to stop like stressing myself out over the fact that there is a big segment of the media world that puts such a premium on getting stuff quickly that sometimes accuracy is compromised. That's going to happen whether I stress myself out about it or not. And again, because there are other people that like make those quick turnaround breaking news stories their specialty, perfect. They can do it and I can concentrate on other stuff. So certain things I accept, and then other stuff I don't mind because it keeps me free to do other stuff.
You know, that's one of the one things that I actually respect and appreciate you about you, Morgan, is because you're telling different stories, but in an authentic way that is teaching and giving information. And I think that is a powerful tool, because I've had a bunch of interviews where you didn't want the story, you wanted to create a narrative. And it was kind of because of that where I was just like, yeah, I'm not going to give any more interviews for quite some time. But
you tell me a time that happened. Tell me.
Man.
So I know specifically what we're responding to.
So it was like when I first came onto the scene in the Olympic sense, right? One of the questions that reporters would always want to know was about my mom. Right. Because of the story, me growing up, you know, we were homeless and all these different things. And what was that dynamics like? But they kept asking me, like, what about my dad? And I was like, family stays family. If I don't want to talk to you about it, I'm not going to talk to you about it. Mm-hmm. Me and my dad have a great relationship. It was because of him that we left Jamaica for in search of a better life, so to speak. And this reporter, you know, he got through to my high school teacher, and, you know, we're on the phone, and he says, man, Akeem, like, I heard that your dad left you guys and moved from Jamaica and, you know, kind of abandoned you guys. I'm like, where are you getting this from? Like, this was never any of that. I'm like, yo, what are you talking about? And I did not do a single interview going into the whole high school thing, because I'm just like, you're not going to twist my words or twist anything that I say and create something that that's not true. Have you ever had a moment where the frustration and maybe like the growth or blurred lines. Like, I think about your tenure at Metro Star, right? And what made you leave, right? Were there some frustration there? Were there...
Okay, these are different questions now.
Yeah. Was it something that you said, you know, my time here is up? Did you know? Or were there more behind it that made you leave? Like, when is the right time to leave?
Oh, okay. So I'll tell you this. Basically, it was two things going on. One is that, you know, at the Toronto Star, like at a lot of news organizations, like money was an issue. And, you know, the most important, the most expensive elements of doing business at a newspaper are the people, are a huge expense, and like paper and ink. Right. Wow. So when you see newspapers get smaller, like physically smaller, part of it is someone has decided they can save money on paper by making the paper physically smaller. But then they're also always trying to save money on people. A lot of ways you can do that. You can just stop hiring. And when people leave, don't hire to replace them. In a union shop, you can lay people off, but like laying people off gets rid of the younger, cheaper people first. If you want to get rid of the older people, you have buyouts, right? Mm-hmm. Because the size of your buyout package is tied to how long you've been at the company. And so at the Star, it just got to the point where they would buy people out every year. It would be like it's like pruning a bush, like, you know? And so, and that just became just a fact of life. Every year, you knew they were going to try to buy people out. And so on the one hand, there's the yearly buyouts. On the other hand, you know, I was just stuck under this glass ceiling. I had accomplished enough of the Star and done enough to like carve out, you know, my lane, that I wasn't really going to grow like as a journalist and or be able to contribute my best to the organization as just like this general assignment sports reporter or as a beat reporter just writing 162 baseball game stories a year, you know. And, you know, I wanted to be a columnist. And every year, whoever was in charge had some type of reason why they couldn't promote me. So basically, it got to the point where I just kept looking at these buyouts every year. And I said to myself, either they will promote me to columnist or they will pay me more than a year's salary to leave this place. Mm. And whichever of those things happen, that's what I'll do. So every year, hey, why don't you promote me to columnist? Oh, we'd love to, but budgets. Oh, we'd love to, but if you do this, then we can't get anyone to replace it. It's always some type of reason, right? But again, there was, you know, if they want to promote a white person, they do it. If they want to hire some white person from someplace else, they do it. The point is, and this is not to say that like every decision was racist or racial, but the point is, if you want to do something, if something is a priority, you find a way to do it instead of finding reasons not to do it. But like where we worked, you know, I was just under that glass ceiling. There's always these reasons not to promote me. So 2019 came and they like towards the end of the year, they're, you know, the message went out from HR. Yeah. They were buying people out. Email us to see what your payout is. So I emailed them and they're, and you can tell how bad they want you gone by how quickly that email comes back. And so I sent the email, hey, run my numbers. And this year it came right back to me. They were ready. And it was like 54 weeks pay. So I was like, okay, sounds good. I asked my wife, I was like, hey, well, how would you feel if I took a buyout from the Star? She's like, do it. So I took a buyout. That was the end of 2019. And then from there I started work on the book and then the pandemic hit. But for me, knowing it was time to leave, it was a question of like, was I growing as a writer, as a journalist in the role I was in? And the answer to that was no. Mm. And like for more money, whatever, I could have traded that for a little stagnation, but like, you know, the money I was making was good. But I didn't, for me, it wasn't worth the stress of knowing I could be doing more, but not being able to do it because I was up against this glass ceiling. And so, like I said, I had the metric.
Yeah.
If the glass ceiling breaks first, then that's what I'll do. I'll move on up. if the glass ceiling don't break, but they offer me a bunch of money to leave, then I'll leave. And so then, yeah, I left. Because again, like the stories I've been doing, I wasn't going to do it with the Star. The Star's not going to send me to Las Vegas to write about Devin Haney, you know? They're not going to send me there to write about Canelo or whoever. And so I've been able to do a lot of stories that if I had stayed at the Star, I wouldn't be doing. And I'd be reading someone else doing those stories and mad because I know I could do them better. So
yeah,
it worked out. And again, it gave me time to do the book and finish the book. And if you're good and your company doesn't appreciate you, but especially in our business, because the work is public facing, there's someone else that appreciates you. Because one of the things that happened was, again, this is after years and years of, we can't promote you because of this or that, or we don't know how to use your skill set. We don't know what to do with you in my day job. But as I was tweeting my little tweet thread about leaving the Star, this was like on a Friday night in December, as I'm mid-thread and I'm getting DMs from CBC, from a book publisher, you know what I'm saying? So they knew my book, yeah. They knew my work, and they're like, we know just what to do with you. And so, yeah, if your work is public facing and you know you're good, even if the people you work for don't quite appreciate you, there's someone that appreciates you, you know?
Yeah. Morgan, last question that I have for you, man. I think that was that's massive advice, great advice right there, man. I want to talk about
imagine Akeem, if you were running 9.9, but Athletics Canada was like, we can't find a place for you on the relay team, and you'd be like, how about first? I don't know. You're like, I run 9.9. Yeah, but this other guy runs 10.01. That's almost as fast. No, that's not as fast. I run 9, right?
Mm-hmm.
And your other passport says Jamaica. And then Athletics Jamaica calls and says, you run 9.9 like running first?
I'm gone. Right. It's
like, you know what I'm like saying?
It's no ifs, ands, or buts.
Yeah, but your work is public facing and people know how good you are, right? And
yeah,
there it goes. Yes.
I remember this was like maybe about a month ago, man. I was talking to my wife about this. I was like, it's kind of a sad shame sometimes where in this world, you can often feel more underappreciated than you will appreciated. And the ones that do appreciate you, they will show it. And sometimes they don't, but it's just an interesting format behind it, man, which brings me to the last question, Morgan, which is your TED Talk, right? Race, okay. Sports,
yeah.
And telling true stories.
Yes.
You've always stood down on your authentic self, right? Like being true to who you are. If you talk about something, you double down on it.
Yeah. But
what does telling true stories look like to you, man? Like, what was the thought process behind that TED Talk? Because that's not an easy message to share in a room that may not look like you. Right?
Yes. Well, with me, it's similar to what you mentioned before with reporters asking you about your dad and then writing a story that they thought was true or that sounded like it made sense to them but wasn't necessarily true.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But the thing is, if no one else jumps up to say, hey, that's not how it went, then you just wind up going with that. And that story becomes the truth just because it gets repeated, mm-hmm. Right? And as a lifelong consumer of sports media, yeah, I just started noticing how these stories about different types of Black athletes get written. You know, and how athletes get slotted into like either talented or hardworking. The Black ones tend to get categorized as talented. The white ones tend to get categorized as hardworking. And you know this because you're a professional athlete. The truth is all the people at the top are a lot of both. Yeah. You know what I mean? But the way sports, you know, we in the sports media have just categorized it. You know, we set up this false dichotomy between talent and work ethic. And with the white people on one side and the Black people on the other. And then we also prize work ethic over talent.
Mm-hmm.
Which again is like, and which is a way for white people who buy into stereotypes and to create stereotypes, to flip privilege on his head and tell Black people that we're privileged. Well, you're only good because you were born that way. You didn't earn it like we did, which is a fallacy, right? You've been at the top level. You see all kinds of, and there are people who are, who like have a high starting point or whatever, but like, you're not making an Olympic final unless you have a lot of talent, but also work at it. That's it. You can work as hard as you want, but if you don't have talent, if you didn't choose the right parents, it don't matter how hard you work. Like Michael Phelps is a hardworking swimmer. You put him on a running track, it don't matter how hard he trains to run. His talent is not running. He's going to get
don't got it. Yep. Time.
There you go. Right. And so what I wanted to do was just get the audience to be a little more discerning in the way they consume sports media, the way they consume stories about Black athletes. And if you're on the media side, to be more discerning and more careful about the stories you choose to tell about people, and the way you go about telling those stories, and the importance of looking at athletes, whether they're Black or white or any place in between, as human beings and not just stereotypes or archetypes. And so, because when you, yes, because my beef is that when you force people into these archetypes, you lose the truth in a lot of these stories. So if I want to tell this story about Fred Curley, who's clearly extremely talented.
Yeah.
But he's hardworking. And if I focus on his talent at the expense of his work ethic and the plan that he and his coach have put together and the way they execute, then that's not the true story. If I just portray him as one more Black athletic savant who cannot help running 9.8, he just came out of the womb that way, then I'm not really, but it's an easy story to tell.
Absolutely.
And again, and to people that don't know that world, it makes sense to them. And to people that only know stereotypes, it makes sense to them, but that don't mean it's the true story. So that was what I wanted to get into. And again, like if you know, we talk about Black athletes in ways that we don't talk about white athletes, in the sense that when you get a group of white people, and this is all in the TEDx talk, but like you get a group of white people that dominates a sport, when you start in, first of all, the idea that we have to investigate every time a group of Black people gets good at something, right? Why are these Black people so good at something? And then the investigation always goes to genetics, which is fine, but genetics is also what underpins talent in just about everything.
Yep.
So that doesn't make those superstar athletes any different from the superstar athletes and superstar musicians, whatever. You know, but it did strike me that like when a group of white people dominates any one thing, we don't investigate. We don't try to take like the best of them and bring them to a laboratory and biopsy their muscles to try to understand, right? You know, what makes these white people so good at skiing, what makes these white people so good at skating, what makes these white people so good at hockey. You just kind of accept that white people are going to be excellent at stuff. And then when some group of non-white people starts dominating a given sport, oh, now we got to ask questions because it's not supposed to be this way. You people are not supposed to dominate. But then you get enough generations of it. Now it's like, yeah, those people are supposed to dominate, but here's why, because we've investigated. And again, like when the white people dominate, like white Americans dominate swimming, like to the extent that we interrogate that, we come up with like these systemic answers. Well, the answers that deal with systems, our coaching is better, our youth development is better, or on that person's work ethic. Whereas with Black people, it's only what you can find in the laboratory, and that is the sum total of what makes that person good, is if that person also did not have to work. Because guess what? Because if you got 8 Olympic finalists, all African diaspora, one of them still got to be the best. Which means one of them still got to be most talented, best prepared, which means they all still got to work and they all still have to have like a smart plan, like a year-long plan that they got to execute. So like this idea that, you know, Black athletes excel because our parents gave us the cheat code is not really true. And so that's what I wanted to explore and just try to get people to keep in mind, you know, that talent work ethic, dedication. These things are not mutually exclusive. But and again, like, you know this from your years as an athlete. You know, you worked with like Uncle Stu. Mm-hmm. And he's very like philosophical and very, very, very thoughtful about stuff. And like, you try to come at them with like a binary question. Hey, what's more important, mobility or weight training? The answer is always going to be, it depends.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, it even, man, even when he said that, like it brings me back to John Wooden, right?
Yeah.
Where he would say, it's not rocket science, play the best athletes.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, but there was a part in your TEDx, man, that actually made me laugh like out loud when you said, when there were people are like, oh, what's the cheat code? And then you hit Jamaica. It was like, is it the yams? Is it the cheat? You know, and I was just like, yo, I've gotten that a bunch of times.
Yeah.
In my life as well, too. But it's true, you know, but it's like there's always more to it than just what you can see, you know. And I like the illustration where you said, Michael Phelps coming onto the track. He's still Michael Phelps, but he's not Michael Phelps on the track.
Yeah, his talent is elsewhere. And like, you can valorize and lionize and idolize him for his hard work, but his hard work pays off a lot better in a pool than it would in a track. And on the track, he would hit the ceiling very quickly. And that's just, that's that. And so again, like, the talent and the hard work, they only matter with each other in the context of like being in the activity that allows you to showcase all of it. Yeah. But the way we in the sports media like to tell these stories and categorize these athletes, it's the hardworking white person versus the talented black person, and that's it. And these two things are mutually exclusive, and you as a consumer have to choose one. You have to choose the one you think is more important to success, when the reality is it's all these things together.
I always say, man, I'm like, man, if you're going to tell my story, tell the whole tale. Because I'm gonna be angry if you don't tell the whole tale and make me look like a fool. You know what I'm saying? So, Morgan, man, thank you so much, man. You've been gracious with your time. I'm really appreciative of it. If we'll close out with this, man. We'll close out with you, man. If there was a message that you could share with someone who wants to get into the space, man, with all your experience in it, the highs, the lows, what is a practical word that you could give to them that might be helpful for them on their path?
Good question. Identify your strengths, keep them strong. Identify your weaknesses and shore them up. Like, your weaknesses don't have to become your strengths. Like, that's a fallacy. Like I said, and you would understand this from the track and field world. You got a person that, like, Christian Coleman, he runs 6'3". And like, that's what he does. Mm-hmm. And like, can he improve the back half of his 100 meter race? Yes. But if he just hammers away at like speed endurance at the expense of his acceleration and top speed, then you have a guy that like still probably never gets great at the back end, but has sacrificed his front end. Right. So like, some people are good at the skills in the job. Other people are really good at kissing ass and just like managing up. And that's just the truth of it. Right. I don't write very well. I don't report very well. I'm not super perceptive, but I have great relationships with my managers. I make them feel good about themselves and they promote me. Right. Yeah. So for me, I'm not good at that. Yeah. And the thing is, like, if I spent all my time like getting good at that, I still would never be great at it. And it would take away from the things I do really well. So I just get good enough at that, you know, at maintaining relationships, being cool with people. And then also just like, you know, the editors I tend to deal with are cool people and aren't people that need their asses kissed. And that works for me. And so, you know, but each of us going into journalism, you kind of got to figure out what you're good at, what you're not good at, and be honest with yourself about it. In terms of like the skills, you have to read, you have to write, like you have to practice these things. This I think it's lost. And it's like a cliche that the best writing is rewriting, but it's also true. And like, I'm very good at writing on deadline as well. So if I have to write 800 words quickly, I can do that. And it's essentially what runs in the paper is my first draft. But that also is because of practice. Mm. Right. And so if you're not like working on your writing, but then also working on your reporting, because your output is really only as good as your input.
Yeah.
Then you're never going to be as good at the craft. If the craft is what means something to you, you're never going to be as good at the craft as you would be if you took those things more seriously, like gave some thought to the questions you asked. You have to know what you want to know before you ask, Link. Sports writers, we love talk about questions because it's easy. Because you don't have to do any work. You just stick your microphone in the guy's face. You say, talk about that goal. And the guy starts talking, right? It's easy, and I understand why we do it, because everyone's on a tight timeline. But like, if you're doing a different type of story, like the talk about questions aren't going to cut it. Like, you have to have a better idea of the things you're trying to know. But then also be flexible in the interviews, because you have to listen to what the person's saying to you, because their answer might prompt more questions. Like a lot of times when I try to email people to set up an interview, and they're like, well, what are your questions going to be? I'm like, I have a few questions, but a lot of my questions depend on the answers you give me. And then that also, and same thing when people say, what's the story going to be about? I'm like, it depends on the answers you give me.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I start interviewing you and you say you love running for Team Canada, then that's what the story's about. If I start interviewing you and you say you hated running for Team Canada, then
that's what the story's about. Yeah.
Depends. So I can't, like, to your point about like having the story already formed in your head, like you can kind of have some ideas that you want to explore, but if the story's already formed in your head, then why bother writing it? It's already done. But yeah, attention to detail in the craft to me is paramount if you just want to get good at the craft. Career-wise, relationships do matter. Again, and you don't, unless you are like a born sycophant and like that, and there are people like that, but like, if you're not, you don't have to turn yourself into one to succeed. Like, but just understand that like authentic relationships are what's going to get you from point A to point B and help you, you know, create and take advantage of these opportunities. But the opportunities only mean something to the extent that you are prepared to take advantage of it. It's not different from a sport. It is very similar to a sport. Glenroy calls you, say, hey, we need you to run first at this meet, run leadoff. If you've been at home with a pot belly drinking beer all winter,
you're not.
Then it doesn't matter if he calls you, right? But yeah. You've been at the track. Hey, man, I did a time trial. 9:09. I'm ready to go. Boom. Then you're done. So it's very similar. Yeah.
Orion, thank you so much, man. As long as you keep writing, I'm going to continue reading, man, because you wrote about power slap the other day, and I thought that's an interesting little sport. Or
I thought we were going to talk boxing, man. I wore the George Dixon t-shirt because I figured
I know.
You asked about it. I thought we were
let's do this.
My boy Corey hit me up. Corey Erdman. He does a lot of play-by-play in boxing, also sometimes in track and field. And he hit me up. He's like, yo, did you know that Akeem Haynes is like this boxing YouTuber now? I'm like, yeah, I saw on his Instagram, man. Like, you know how many people get excited over meeting Larry Holmes? Only you and me. That would be about it. Me and Corey.
You know what, man? You know, it wouldn't be right if I didn't ask you about this, man, because there's obviously a whole bunch of speculation about Ryan Garcia and Tank, right? Mm-hmm. And we're hoping to see the fight. Yeah. Until we see the contract, you know, we can't see, but Biden, we get it. The early anticipation of it, man. How do you think that one plays out?
First things first, Tank Davis has a court case in February. Yeah.
Not a lot of people know that one.
And so if that goes the wrong way, and it might, none of this might matter. I won't give a prediction, but I will say this. I think both of these guys are going to be the fastest guy the other person has ever faced.
100%.
The difference being that Davis, like, we know that he can adjust to another fighter's speed, to their power, to their size. You know, and we've seen him, like, solve problems on the fly, right? Whether that's against Mario Barrios or, like, Romero, who's, like, better, big, powerful, awkward, better than we thought he would be. Garcia is really fast, but he also looks faster by contrast because he has not fought other fast guys.
Yeah.
We've also seen Garcia on the deck. So Garcia's big challenge is kind of imposing his speed while adjusting to Tank's speed while also not walking into
that left hand
or the right hand, either hand.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas Davis only has to adjust to the speed because we know Davis knows how to fight other good fighters. And we know Davis is capable of making adjustments, and he's a very good tactical boxer.
Yes.
So like from here, it seems like Davis has a few fewer hurdles to clear to win that fight. Whereas Garcia has to solve the speed, solve for the occasion. Like Garcia also not had been in, hasn't been in big fights the way Davis has. And then also find a way either to withstand Davis's power, which no one can do. Davis gets knockouts like early rounds through the late rounds, or just not get hit. And we've seen Garcia on the deck. And so it's an intriguing matchup.
Yes.
Davis is convinced, not Davis, well, Davis is convincing him too, but Garcia is convinced he can win this fight. Like, there's a reason why he pursued this fight as opposed to other lightweights. But at the same time, like, everyone who Davis fights, they all think they have the solution too.
Yeah.
It's an intriguing matchup. I think I'm going to stop short of making a prediction, but I think Davis just has a smoother path to victory than Garcia does. And that, again, that like that power is such a big variable. And it's not like Davis is a, like an undisciplined free swinging slugger who you can, you know, you can use his aggressiveness against him. Like, he is very smart about setting up his power and deploying his power. Like, he's a boxer puncher in the truest sense, and that's what makes him such a big problem for like anybody, you know, in that weight range.
I don't think he gets enough credit for his actual boxing skills. You know what I'm saying?
I'll put it to you like this: at the world class level, you don't get to hit people like that unless you're exceptionally skilled.
Mm-hmm.
You get those highlight reel knockouts on the way up because the talent gap is so big. But once you're fighting the other best people in the world, they don't just give you those shots. Like, you have to find, you see that real small opening and you take it.
Yeah. Right?
So, yeah. You, and the only way you do that is with skill. It's not luck. And it's not just pure power.
Man, so. I hope it gets finalized. Those ticket prices are going to be crazy. Yes. But, you know, man, you and I could talk boxing for another 6 more hours, man. I've already taken too much of your time, man.
Yeah, so, I got to go. Yeah. Speaking of deadlines, I got to go hit one right now.
Anytime you want to talk about boxing, man, we'll make it happen.
All right, we'll do it.
Thanks so much for your time, man. I really appreciate it.
All right, stay safe out here.
You too, man.